The following is a presentation of Wisconsin Public Television.
What qualities do you look for in a state's attorney general?
If he lives up to his word, he lives up to everything that he said he would do.
Honesty, integrity, and experience.
Impartiality, good sense of ethics.
What qualities make a good neighborhood?
Safety is a big thing, and a little bit of green grass.
I'm dealing in love. Love your neighbor.
Who would you rather watch, Dan Rather or Bart Simpson?
Bart Simpson, although they're not really much different.
I prefer Dan Rather.
Bart Simpson?
Bart Simpson, hands down. Yeah, every night.
Good evening, I'm Renee Riddle.
And I'm Dave Iverson. We're happy to have Renee here tonight from Channel 12 as tonight's guest host. You can tell we're in our auction mode tonight. We're getting ready for the big public TV auction. So in that spirit, we're going to auction off a T-shirt here tonight. Here's the number to call if you'd like it. You have to name that man, the last man who was on our open who made that comment about preferring Bart Simpson to Dan Rather. If you know who he is, call up real quick. The first viewer to call 1-800-348-9529 will get this extra special weekend T-shirt as part of our auction identity tonight.
All right.
Phone's ringing. I better go answer.
Go for it, Dave. Well, we'll spend some time tonight talking about identity. Name ID is part of every political race. And this week, Attorney General Jim Doyle announced he's running for re-election. He'll tell us why in just a few moments. Also tonight, the Great American Affiliate Swap took place this week. We'll look at what new station IDs mean for Milwaukee. And then we'll look at the nature of neighborhoods. Art Hackett reports tonight on a controversial plan to take suburbs back to the future. And while stations and suburbs struggle with creating new identities, how about the schools? We'll talk about what schools must do to sell themselves to local voters. And even though we're on a different set, we hope you know where you are on the dial and join us for tonight's edition of Weekend.
Also tonight, Dr. Ted Goodfriend reports on the nature of the strep infection that has Great Britain on edge and has caused the death of one Madison man. Health reporting on tonight's program is made possible in part by a grant from the University of Wisconsin Children's Hospital, caring for Wisconsin's children.
And we already have a winner. It was Ed Marion, the governor's former chief of staff, who made that comment about liking Bart Simpson. We'll get the T-shirt off in the mail in just a moment. All right, on to the rest of tonight's business. We start tonight with the race for attorney general. 4 years ago, it was Jim Doyle who was the challenger. He went on, of course, to knock off incumbent Republican Don Hanaway. This time, it's Doyle, the Democrat, who wants 4 more years. The attorney general made it official on Monday with his official reelection announcement. Over the past 4 years, he lists these accomplishments, that he's worked to toughen state penalties for violent crimes, that he's helped create juvenile boot camps, established a background check hotline on gun buyers, and that his office has achieved a 95% conviction rate in drug cases. And the attorney general joins us now. Welcome. Congratulations, I guess, wanting to do this for 4 more years. Attorney General Doyle, the mood of the legislature, and indeed, I guess, the country in recent months, and it has been one to get tough on crime. Everyone seems preoccupied with getting tough on crime. What's rhetoric? What's reality?
Well, I think that there is a growing consensus, and I hope there is, which is that we do need to get tough on crime, that people who commit violent offenses need to be locked up for long periods of time. We need to have proposals to move them swiftly through the system and have them incarcerated. But that's not the end of it. I think that there's the consensus that's growing as well is that we need to take steps to try to deal with what causes it. And in a couple of areas that I've worked very hard in, believe very strongly about, are child abuse, neglect, and prevention. We've received a large federal grant, have been involved in a major effort around the state to train police officers, social workers, treatment professionals, and others in how to detect, prevent child abuse and neglect. and in trying to reform the juvenile justice system. So I think that there definitely is a mood of get tough, but I think that there's also a recognition that we have to deal with problems of young offenders, of abused and neglected children, of ready accessibility to guns, and of those kinds of causes as well.
Your opponent is also going to be, I'm sure, leading Get Tough on Crime campaign. And by the way, Mr. Wagner will join us on this program in 2 weeks. But tell us why you'd be tougher than him as an attorney general. Why would you be the best guy to be tough on crime?
Well, I think I'm the best guy to be effective in dealing with crime. We have made enormous advances in my time as attorney general. Our drug officers have made arrests in double the year before I took office, for example. We have greatly increased the capability of the crime labs. We've opened a new crime lab in Wausau. We've doubled the size of Milwaukee's lab. We've brought new technology to the effort in the fight against crime, DNA testing, the automated fingerprint information system, a vastly improved communication system for law enforcement. We've led legislative efforts to try to toughen measures as well. But as I also say, I'm willing to also say we have to look beyond those measures and try to get to some of the causes of it as well.
Mr. Doyle, let's narrow the focus a bit on crime to juvenile crime. It's already been tops on your agenda. You've pressed for change in creating boot camps for juvenile offenders and also insisting that once juveniles are waived into adult court, that they're waived for life. But now you say that juvenile crime is the biggest challenge facing law enforcement today. Why?
Well, there's no doubt about it. As I travel around the state, talk to law enforcement officials, judges, whether I'm in the farthest northern counties of the state or the most populous counties in southeast Wisconsin, if I ask them, what's the major problem you're confronting? The answer is uniformly juvenile crime. And the numbers bear it out. The crime rate in Wisconsin has actually declined somewhat over in recent years in almost every category. But at the same time, we have had the same problem the rest of the country has had of a sharply increased juvenile crime. I think we need to do a couple of things, and I've been working very hard at this. One is to reform fundamentally the juvenile code in this state. I think we need to bring the idea of consequences and punishment into the juvenile code. The second thing, though, is we need to back that up with resources. And I think we need to focus on first and second offenders, and we need good community-based kinds of resources. You know, it costs $45,000 a year to send a young offender to Wales or Lincoln Hills. Those are often third, fourth, fifth offenders. There is little money left to deal with the first offender who comes in, and I want to see that we have work restitution programs, mandatory study programs, tightly supervised curfews, loss of privileges like driving. I want to give judges a range of options that they currently don't have to deal with that first offender who's coming into the juvenile court system.
And that's something your challenger is pushing real hard on also. In fact, just today he said that the whole juvenile system should be scrapped and we should start over. And he's pushing for any juvenile who commits a crime, a violent crime or a crime with a gun, should automatically be waived into adult court. Can you be tougher than that?
I'm not going to get into this. Look who's tougher. Here's a guy who has never been in a juvenile court in the state of Wisconsin in his life telling us we're supposed to scrap the whole system. There are a lot of good things going on, very dedicated juvenile judges, very dedicated police officers who work in juvenile areas, dedicated community workers who run youth restitution programs. The problem is that we have a code that needs basic reforming, and we need to put resources into it. I've been in juvenile courts my whole career as a prosecutor, as a lawyer who's represented families in juvenile court, as attorney general. I think it's a matter of us taking a system in Wisconsin, making some very fundamental changes. But just saying, oh, let's do away with the system really isn't a very constructive kind of response to the problem we have.
Let's spend a moment on guns. There's been, in part at least, it seems, a bit of a sea change in this country in terms of our attitude about guns. The people of Milwaukee will have a chance in November, if it all goes according to plan, to vote on whether or not there ought to be handguns in that city. Would you like them to vote for that ban?
I have stayed away from the local referenda, both in Madison and Milwaukee, for a very simple reason. I have been pushing for a number of very major proposals on the state level. And to get embroiled in a local ordinance, I believe cities, municipalities have the right to make their own choices about those sorts of things. But to get embroiled in that is really going to detract from what I'm trying to do on the state level. And on the state level, over the last 3.5 years, I have been leading proponent of a number of changes, and frankly, I'm the one who has provoked the debate in the legislature. If it weren't for some proposals I've made, they really never would have been talking about guns. We passed the first mandatory background check and have stopped the sale of guns to over 600 convicted felons in this state since we've set up the handgun hotline. I have pressed for the need to have permit judges to take guns away from people who have been mentally committed because of dangerousness, which the legislature just passed. I think it's time the legislature pass proposals that permit judges to take guns away from people who have subject to domestic abuse injunctions, child abuse injunctions, and stalking. And I think we really need to focus on the proliferation of the little short-barreled handguns that I know we've talked about on this show, and that really, when you look at what's going on in this state, that is the weapon that is involved in most offenses involving guns in this state.
Attorney General Joyle, we're happy to have you here. One last thought on the campaign ahead. You, in that headline we saw in our open, you said that you expected attacks. Do you think this is going to be a particularly nasty, negative campaign?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. The Republicans have already said I'm their number one target in this campaign. They've always already been burning the fax machines around this state with, you know, ugly pictures of me that say that I'm this and that, all kinds of name-calling. In fact, we've already had editorial writers in this state already have, at this early stage in the race, have already been writing about the negative nature of the attack. Frankly, I'll stick to the issues. I think the last Senate campaign in this state showed that the voters of this state simply aren't going to fall for this stuff. A lot of screaming and a lot of rhetoric is not the answer to dealing with the very important issues that the Attorney General has to deal with.
All right, we'll hope to have you back with your opponent later in the campaign. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Jeff Wagner will be with us 2 weeks from tonight. Attorney General Doyle, thanks.
Thank you.
Still to come on Weekend, the rest of the week's news, the Great Milwaukee Channel Swap, and the intrepid Art Hackett heads for the Burbs.
Now here's our summary of the rest of the week's news. In Milwaukee today, two men are under arrest for murder. Those men are Milwaukee police officers. The two officers are being held in connection with the fatal shooting of a 24-year-old man who worked as a bouncer at a Chicago bar. One suspect is a 12-year veteran of the Milwaukee Police Department. The other joined the force 2 years ago from Chicago. And as if he didn't have enough troubles, we've discovered yet another headache for embattled Illinois Congressman Dan Rostenkowski. It turns out Rosty owns two homes in Kenosha with a total value of over $600,000, and he's behind on his property taxes. Apparently, Rostenkowski inadvertently underpaid on one of his Kenosha homes and now owes $187 in interest and penalties. The on-again, off-again information superhighway bill was back on the on-ramp yesterday. Lawmakers had yet another briefing on the complex legislative proposal that would provide for private construction of the highway, a reduction in some phone rates, and the opportunity for phone companies to make higher profits. 1 year after the disastrous flood of 93, a government panel is calling for a new approach to flood control. Instead of putting more money into levees and dams, the special government task force says, in essence, that we ought to let the river win. According to the panel, evacuation of floodplains, business relocation, and natural flood cycles are all preferable to traditional flood control practices. And President Clinton named former Defense Secretary Les Aspin to a new position today. Aspin will now chair the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. Dave?
Before we move on to our next story, we should mention that it was Connie Hagan of Madison, Wisconsin, who guessed Eddie Marion as the correct name for the person in our open tonight. She'll get the T-shirt. Should have had more. The phones are really ringing back there. Our local listings feature this evening takes on new meaning tonight as we turn now to the CBS Fox channel swap in Milwaukee. This week, the burgeoning Fox network expanded across the country. It was a surprise alliance with a number of major television stations. The Fox Group added 12 network affiliates nationwide, 8 of whom were with CBS. Among the CBS affiliates switching to Fox was, of course, Milwaukee's WITI TV, Channel 6. Viewers in the Milwaukee market learned about all this from, who else? Channel 6. Here's reporter Charles Benson and with a look at how TV6 covered themselves
Superstar
on Monday.
Bart Simpson would probably describe the big changes as cool, dude. Starting in November, TV6 and 11 other stations across the country are moving to the Fox network. It means TV6 will no longer be a CBS affiliate. It's now part of the Fox family. TV6 president and general manager Andy Potis says news viewers are the winners in this deal.
Oh, this is a real plus for Milwaukee viewers because they can get all the news in the world, and we're going to be even a bigger part of the Milwaukee community than we were before.
TV6 management says it will expand its morning news program, and it will continue to provide national news from CNN. Football fans will also love Fox because you'll be able to watch the Green Bay Packers on Channel 6. CBS no longer has the rights to the NFC games. Media analysts say the move will improve Fox's image.
Obviously, Fox's investment in NFL football has been a big benefit to their image and to their stature in the broadcasting industry. And I think this is just a further example, especially when most all of these stations are in the top 30 markets, that this is significant.
TV6 and the other stations moving to Fox are owned by New World Communications. Today, that stock jumped almost $2 a share, or 20%. While CBS was down $15 a share, or 5%. Charles Benson, TV6 News.
Joining us now for some analysis of what this all means for local television news is the TV critic of the Milwaukee Sentinel, Dwayne Dudek. Dwayne, this is the kind of story that everybody in our business loves to talk about, but what's the significance for Milwaukee viewers? How do they fare in this big channel swap?
Well, there's going to be a tremendous amount of what they call churn in the audience, and viewers are just going to have to reestablish their viewing patterns. Right now, Milwaukee does not have a CBS affiliate. It's inevitable that it will come November or even come the fall television season, but right now there's going to be things are going to stay the same, but by the fall television season, there's going to be a lot of confusion about where to tune into your favorite programs.
We've heard the Channel 6 general manager say that Milwaukee viewers will be the big winners in this, and Channel 6 says that they are going to expand the amount of local news. Is there really an appetite for that, in your judgment? Do people want that?
Very good question. Channel 4, WTMJ, is also adding some news in the afternoon. There's got to be a saturation point. A 6 is forced into this position, of course. They're making lemonade, as they say, because they're losing 40% of their daytime programming and 50% of their nighttime programming. Those statistics may be a little off, but you're losing all your daytime programs, your soaps and your game shows, and they're losing an hour of primetime every night because Fox only goes until 9 o'clock. So they have no choice. They have to fill that programming somehow. Of course, there is the advantage for the affiliate in that they keep all the money in local news programming that they sell in advertising revenue. So it is attractive for them. The question is whether they can, whether they'll appeal to that news audience, because Fox viewers traditionally are not news viewers. They're younger viewers, whereas traditionally the viewers who watch news are married, they have kids, they have a commitment in the community. They're maybe plus 30. The Fox demographics, 18 to 34, not traditionally the news viewing demographics. So there are all sorts of contrasting variables in this right now.
This is too simplistic a question, but in the end, is this a good thing for television journalism? I mean, will this be something that will improve the quality of local news in Milwaukee?
Well, it's certainly going to improve the quantity. I think whether it improves the quality remains to be seen. I'll tell you that Channel 6 is going to do their darndest to retain their core audience, and they're going to have to make some sort of appeal to this younger demographic in some way. It'll be interesting to see how they walk that fine balance, and you can be sure that in Milwaukee, the other two network affiliates, the NBC affiliate and the ABC affiliate, are going to make sure that they don't do just that, so there's going to be an incredible competition at least.
I was watching the CBS special on D-Day, CBS Reports, which is the very first CBS Reports was Edward R. Murrow's Harvest of Shame. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's that long tradition of CBS News, which now Channel 6 will not have. And does that matter much anymore? Does that tradition count?
Well, I think it does. WITI in Milwaukee has built its news image, its local news image, around that institution that CBS provided, and not just the news, but the programming as well. And to a certain degree, it's shaped the WITI demographic in terms of news heritage. Yes, I think that losing Dan Rather and Morley Safer in 60 Minutes and 48 Hours and Charles Correll, who is not anymore, Charles Osgood, I think there's a loss. They're not going to have an identity. Anybody can get CNN. WTMJ in Milwaukee has CNN. That's where they're going to be getting their national and international news from. So is TMJ in a pinch. I think that when you think of ABC, you think of Peter Jennings and Barbara Walters. And when you think of NBC, you think of Tom Brokaw. When you think of CBS, you think of the people I just mentioned. Now, WITI is not going to have those people. And I think that it's going to be to their detriment.
Yeah. Last quick question. What's next? I mean, what's the scuttlebutt in Milwaukee about whether or not CBS lands at an independent like 24, or whether they try to snarf up one of the other affiliates, channels 4 or 12?
Well, yesterday and today, CBS has been making noises like they're going to become very aggressive in this area. They want a equivalent kind of station in each of the markets that they're losing. It's not just Milwaukee. And they're willing to throw the money around. This is going to redefine the network compensation to the affiliates. Right now, they're paying about $1 million a year to the affiliates for the privilege of being able to be in those markets. I see those figures inflating considerably. They're going to try to make it very attractive to existing network affiliates, ABC and NBC affiliates, to come to CBS. Barring that, they'll probably end up on WCGV, the independent station in Milwaukee.
It's sort of like pro football, isn't it, and free agency. Dwayne Dudek, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
From station IDs to neighborhood identity, are the suburbs ready to head back to the future? Art Hackett tackles that topic next on Weekend.
Well, sometime after World War II, many Americans' idea of the ultimate in living became a split-level ranch on a cul-de-sac in suburbia, with two cars in the garage, of course. Well, that ideal still holds for many. So what happens when someone tries to put in a more city-like project next door, a place where you can walk to the store? In fact, you might even live above the store. What happens is you get a controversy, and that's exactly what's happening in Middleton. Art Hackett has that story.
And what the people who live here would call a cul-de-sac, sounds quaint, doesn't it? Duane calls a pod.
The cul-de-sacs and the pods of housing are discontinuous, so that only very, very few streets are through streets, and so they have to be huge. And virtually any street becomes a highway.
Pods. Sounds like something you'd find in The Invasion of the Land Snatchers. And that is one of Duane's goals, eliminating sprawl. His solution is a school of urban planning known as traditional neighborhood design.
It's closer together so that the people feel a kinship.
Madison architect and developer Marshall Erdman selected Duane to lay out what he hopes will occupy this 150 acres of land his family owns, one of the last undeveloped parcels of land in Middleton.
And I wanted to, this, as I called it one time, my swan song, I wanted to do something that at least they could compare and study it and see if there is an improvement over the conventional sprawl.
Well, it's easy to give a minimum.
Last fall, Erdman brought Duane to Madison to design his town of dreams. Duane lectured to a packed house at the University of Wisconsin, where his assault on suburban design as we know it continued.
There's this great mystery that must have entered your mind, which is how is it with such low density in the suburbs and so much asphalt that we have so much traffic congestion? How is this miracle of incompetence achieved? And the reason is that of all the asphalt in suburbia, very little of it is actually used. Because all of it is dead end, all of it is within these pods, and very few of them actually connect.
But the problem with Duane's design is, for the city of Middleton, it doesn't have enough asphalt. City Councilman Don Damon says the project doesn't meet the city's subdivision regulations.
We have said that we need two 10-foot driving lanes if there's no parking at all. So that's a 20-foot street width. If they do want parking on one side, then we need another 8 feet. So that would be 28 feet.
Erdman wanted to build streets just 22 feet wide. The average modern suburban street is a lot wider than that. This is 22 feet. even for a cul-de-sac like this one. The street is 32 feet wide.
They still wanted parking, at least on one side of the main roads in here. They would not allow for our fire equipment and the other vehicles to go through. And so that stopped things right at that commission level.
The street widths are now being negotiated, but Erdman's project faces yet another hurdle. It represents a direct attack on the concept of pods. The plan has as its roots the typical small town. Erdman suggests the Jefferson County community of Lake Mills as an example, with homes within walking distance of the town square and some people living above the stores.
Old-fashioned towns thrive at it by having a grocery store on the corner where you can walk and pick up a loaf of bread, or you can go to the beauty parlor, or you can go to the butcher, and you don't have to get into your car.
However, in Erdman's new development, the shops would be here, directly across the road from existing single-family homes. One of the cardinal rules for suburban design is single-family homes should never touch commercial property without something in between.
Apartments, condos, something. There's always usually something in between before you have commercial. And I have no problem with that. I think that's the way it should be.
The drawback to that, though, is that you often force people to own two cars.
This is true, but people are going to own two cars anyway.
I think some of those things are changing.
Middleton's mayor, Dan Ramsey, supports Erdman's project.
What I see in the reading that I do is a change to smaller lots, less dependency on the car if we can get it, more commercial or mass transit, whether it be by bus or by rail, affordable housing, which means smaller lots, not larger, greater density, not less.
I've been around a little bit to say it won't work. It just won't work. Now, that's not my financially, I don't have to worry about that, but I do as far as our north side of Middleton, I have to worry about it, because I don't want an area that could well become blighted 20 years from now. I won't be here, but someone will.
We're talking about homes that he's figuring will be selling between $100,000 to $250,000.
Yeah,
how can you go from that to blight?
$100,000 isn't a very expensive home today.
When you build a smaller house, you don't build a cheaper house. You build a smaller house for less money. But the design, the quality, the feeling is the same.
I think there's a market for this. I think that it will absorb quickly. I think that it will be successful, and for a lot of reasons.
Not the least of which, says planner Andres Duany, is it may be the only way to make housing affordable.
By forcing every adult to own a car, you basically destroy their ability to afford housing. Part of the reason that the middle class can no longer afford housing is that they're forced to buy so many cars. And I think I've said before that since a car costs $5,000 a year to own on average, that will cover a $50,000 mortgage.
Duany and his colleagues feel the rules of suburban design are tearing the fabric of American society. They want to change those rules.
What we hope to do by this project is to actually have in place a model, which is the alternative, that you'll be able to point to and say, look, developers, it works to build neighborhoods. And maybe we can not go down the same road as Los Angeles.
The way that the mayor and some of the people jumped on the bandwagon, it was like we were going to be a show place. We don't want to be a show place. We want to be Middleton.
It's an experiment worth taking. Nobody can guarantee it, but it makes so much sense logically. Now, whether people will buy it or not remains to be seen.
For now, even the project's supporters acknowledge the city council won't buy it.
So if it were to be taken tonight, I don't even know if there'd be a vote for it because it's not ready.
Ramsey hopes the arguments can be made ready before the council will be asked to vote on the project in July.
Well, whether you live in a city or small town, the character of a neighborhood helps define where you live. So before we move on to the rest of this evening's program, we thought we'd present a short portrait of one neighborhood. So with apologies to CBS's Sunday Morning, we're taking you to the Marquette neighborhood on Madison's Near East Side, as photographed by Wendy Woodward and recorded by Brad Ray.
And still to come, how schools must sell themselves to friends and foe alike. And Dr. Ted Goodfriend on new concerns over strep infections. All tonight on Weekend.
School building referendum. Three words that the mere mention of sends taxpayers usually running. But chances are, if you haven't voted on one recently, you soon may. Since April, 13 school districts in Wisconsin have placed building referenda before voters in our state. The average building cost on the ballot is about $6 million, and of those 13, six have passed, seven have failed. So in an age of growing classroom sizes, spending caps, and skyrocketing property taxes, how do schools go about the business of selling themselves to their communities? Joining us now, John Hawley. He's the president of the Random Lakes School District. This week, voters in his town okayed a $2.5 million building project. And joining us in Green Bay this evening is Al Hippus. He's the vice president of the Kimberly School Board, where voters turned down a $6 million building referendum in both February and again in April.
Well, let's start with John Hawley. I'm sure what a lot of people are wondering, especially in towns where referendums have failed, what is the secret to your success? I mean, $2.5 million is no small chunk of change.
Well, we ran a campaign like you run a campaign for office. The board approved placing the question on the ballot in late April, and we had about 5 weeks. We went out to over 40 different events where board members talked to small groups as small as three or four people, as large as 40 or 50. And we went out and basically sold our product and tried to convince people of the need. I carried a map of our building project around in my car for that whole time and showed it to anybody on the street. We had strong support. The PTA organized a calling group. We had postcards sent out by other groups. We just ran, sold it like you'd sell a campaign.
I was just going to say, it sounds more like a political campaign than, you know, doing something for the schools.
I think that's what you have to do to get the message out to people. It's basically a political process, and you have to go out, and if you have a strong message, as we think we did, you have to go out and convince people that your message is appropriate and they need to support it.
Let's compare that to what happened in Kimberly, Mr. Hippus. Are you picking up any tips here from your colleague, John Hawley?
Yes, I am. I see that he was very active. They had a lot of things going, and we were doing some of the same things. We were trying to be proactive rather than reactive. We felt that we should be doing some planning ahead. We were looking for the fall of 95, and we didn't really have a lot of success because the people could not see, like we could see, the need. We're growing at the rate of about 7% the last couple of years. We see that we're going to grow faster than that in the next year. But we're really still not getting the buy-in. We've had two failures, and now we're looking at, you know, where are we going for the fall of 94 or the spring of 95.
Do you feel that there is an increasing cynicism among the public, not only in your area around the state? Do you feel like that it's just very hard these days to sell people on public education?
It really is, and I think it's the situation with taxes. Young people buying homes, they're stretched a little bit. We have an older segment of society that is saying, hey, it's difficult for us to pay those taxes, and they're hard. It's hard. We have to be convincing to them. We have to make them understand that we have that need. In Kimberly, we really are trying to do what's right for the kids. We want to have the right quality of education. We think that by the fall of 95, we're going to have that need, and that's the way we were planning. But now we have to go back and look to the people and say, what do you really think? Because it's really what the parents want, what the people want in our school district. And so we're going to look at that situation again and have them come to us. They're going to be able to see the situations that come up where we're going to have to rent temporary space in old stores. We're going to have to go out maybe and rent some rooms from parochial schools. We're going to do some of those kind of things. And when the people see that, I think they're going to have a better understanding of what our need is.
But how do you convince voters that their money will be well spent? It just seems like we're really getting tapped out lately, and voters are quite frankly getting fed up. They figure, if we have to budget, why can't you? Did you run into that kind of opposition?
We ran into it a little bit, but I guess I disagree with my colleague to a point. We felt it was important for us to go to the people, not to have them come to us. In fact, we did have two open sessions where people could come to the school and take a look around, but only four or five people came to each of those two sessions, and we felt that we needed to go out in small groups and talk to people. We need to, I guess, convince people to look beyond taxes and convince them that good things are happening in our schools and that they need to be supportive of our schools because they represent our community.
Is it sort of customer service, which is the buzzword in business these days? Is that what you're going to do?
I think that's a big part of it. We can't be successful as a school district unless our community supports us. And unfortunately, but for big events, football games, basketball games, plays, they don't come to us. So we need to go out to them. And some of our strongest critics never come in the school. The day after the referendum passed, I ran into a gentleman in the store, hadn't been in the school in 10 years, but he was convinced we didn't need this.
Mr. Hippis, what do you have to do, do you think, to attract people back in and to attract support once again for what's now fallen in disfavor?
I think we have to look at the situation. We have to bring the people in. We did the same as my colleague did. We had open houses, we had forums, but it was the same nucleus of people that would show up. There seems to be a lot of apathy in town. A lot of people were not aware of the referendum coming up. They didn't know what the issue was. And yes, we have to go out and convince them of what the status is and what our needs are. And we think that in the fall, when we have the students registering again, that way we'll be able to demonstrate, hey, this is what the population is. This is what the number of students we have in our rooms. This is what the crowding situation is. Now, this is the fall of 94. We're projecting for the fall of 95. So we'll have a better read in the fall of 94, and then we'll also get a better read on the people of what their expectations and what their needs are.
Texas public schools recently had a consultant who recommended, I don't know if either of you saw this story a few weeks back, but they recommended that they ought to drop the word public out of public schools. They decided not to do that. But I mean, public education isn't exactly everyone's favorite topic these days, John Hawley.
I think that's really true. And we as school boards and administrators and teachers need to go out and convince our community that our schools are worthy of support. And in Random Lake, we haven't always been able to do that. But I think we now, after going through this process, have a better idea of what we need to do. If public school choice comes to be in a lot of kids are leaving Random Lake to go to Cedar Grove, then I know we've got a problem. But I think we need to go beyond that now and get our community behind us. And in our community are a lot of people who I think can help us. They not only, once we get them convinced that we're on the right track, they have expertise that can help us through apprenticeships or just through speaking in classes, mentoring students, things like that. The school needs to be a whole community effort and not just a financial effort. And we can't just have contact with people at tax time. We need to have contact with them all the time.
But how do you impress the importance on voters that really they're deciding the fate of their children and the future of our country through the voting booths?
I mean, hard work, yeah. I think, is really what it is, and you can't wear down. I think you need to just talk to people over and over and over. I called a gentleman at 7:45 Tuesday morning to one last chance to try to convince him to the need to support this project. I think you just have to keep at it, like you do selling any product.
Mr. Hippis, do you think that to an extent the sort of bitter debate we've seen here in Madison at the state legislature over the topic of property taxes has sort of, I don't know, soured the mood, generally speaking? So that these distinctions get blurred? I mean, you may want to build a new building, but people are ticked off about something else down here. Has all of this gotten kind of mushed together in people's minds?
I think people are confused. They see the situation with the property tax, where you know that proposition is coming through and it's changing the way we look at property taxes, and people are concerned that if we do take the property taxes off the rolls, off the school rolls, that we're going to be losing quite a bit of control. I get a little bit concerned about that because I see the fact that if the legislature and the people in the state government have the dollars in their control, what happens to the local control? We're not able to spend the dollars that we think need to be spent. And what happens to the dollars? They may be directed to other areas of the state that we have no control over.
Well, Mr. Al Hippis, thank you for joining us. Maybe you have a few tips for better luck next time. And John Hawley, we appreciate you being here too. And stay tuned for voters in Waupun next week deciding on a $14 million referendum. So we'll see.
And coming up next, Dr. Ted Goodfriend on why strep can sometimes have serious consequences.
Last week, a well-liked Madison High School counselor and minority representative died of a strep infection. It's the same condition that killed the creator of the Muppets, Jim Henson, a few years back, and a cluster of similar cases have now gotten people quite nervous in Great Britain. What's going on with all of this? Well, we've asked Ted Goodfriend to join us and help us explain. Ted, let's start with the bug. Tell us what you can about the bug itself.
The streptococcus is a germ that we thought we had pretty much conquered. It's a common infectious organism, usually thought of as infecting the throat, strep throat. It also can affect the skin, and it hurts you in two ways. The most well-known way is a delayed effect. You become immune to the strep, your immunity crosses and affects your own tissues, so you get rheumatism, and rheumatic fever affects the heart, the brain, the joints, or nephritis, glomerulonephritis. And this, it was a ferocious complication of streptococcal infection.
So it's always been a serious bug, and we have treated it with penicillin. And I think of it as being something you can knock out pretty quickly. What went wrong this time around for not only this man in Madison, Joe Thomas, but in scattered other cases around the world?
Well, the other way the bug can get you is by making toxins that directly affect, poison, destroy your tissue. This is the way germs spread within the body. And these toxins are extremely powerful. In this particular case, a perfectly healthy man, Mr. Thomas, was struck down by a germ that apparently makes a huge amount of a very potent toxin. So before the antibiotic could get to him, could do the job, he was killed by it.
So this was a particularly potent strep infection. It's not something that had to do with his particular condition. This was the germ, not something peculiar to Mr. Thomas.
That's right. He was a perfectly healthy man in the prime of life, very widely respected, by the way. And this germ, which he just happened to catch, was a particularly virulent germ and is apparently related to the very virulent germs that affected the Muppets creator and these people in Great Britain.
Now, in recent months and I suppose recent years, there's been some debate in the medical community about the overuse of antibiotics. How does that tie into this particular story?
It's a very complicated business. For one thing, the bug in this case, the strep, is still susceptible to penicillin. We have been extremely fortunate. We have not seen the rise of germs of the streptococcus class that are resistant to penicillin. So penicillin could cure this germ, but we are probably using penicillin so much on sore throats that we ourselves, the people who have strep, don't have any chance to develop our own immunity to streptococcal infection. So we are now dependent, as you were, on on penicillin.
So what kind of position does that put you in? If docs are prescribing penicillin too easily, yet you read stories about like what happened in Madison last week, what do you do?
This is an unanswerable question. You're talking to the wrong guy because I'm a well-educated coward in this situation. I had rheumatic fever when I was a boy, so when I get a sore throat, I'm right in there with the penicillin. Let me try to be a little more balanced in my advice. If you get a sore throat that you are pretty sure is part of a cold, of a viral infection, you have a runny nose, you have a headache, your eyes are tearing, people around the house or around the classroom or around your office all have this bug, and you happen to have a sore throat as part of it, I wouldn't be too alarmed. But if you have a sore throat that begins to debilitate you, that gives you a dizziness, that makes you ache, that makes you say, this isn't a cold, I'm really sick, I would hie thee to a doctor very fast.
So a little bit of educated cowardice is not a bad thing.
No, and fortunately, these germs are still susceptible to antibiotics. By the way, I should add, the drug companies make a big fuss about how we shouldn't hit them too hard because they want to keep up in research. This is one area where drug companies are research is really being beneficial. They are inventing new antibiotics all the time, and I think that is a valuable segment of research to perpetuate.
All right, Ted Goodfriend, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
It's Memorial Day weekend, and the fun-loving weekend political panel is here to throw a few politicians on the old grill and turn up the flames. That's next on Weekend.
Our political panel joins us now to wrap up the week. We have Steve King, Camille Haney, and Linda Green, who formed this week's edition. And our first topic is the upcoming Republican State Party Convention, an event that won't start until next weekend, but because public television's auction preempts us, as you've noticed from our set next weekend, we thought we'd better take it up now. So here's what Camille Haney has to say about those events. Quote, political conventions are like family reunions. Camille?
Well, like families, political parties are about relationships, and traditions like conventions or like Lincoln Day dinners or Jefferson Day dinners are all a part of that process. And I attended my first Republican political convention almost 30 years ago, and I hate to say it on this politically correct panel, but I was a Knowles girl. And working for the late Governor Warren Knowles when he was running for governor, and my job was to get the balloons all put together and to get all of the Knowles girls organized to lead the parade around the convention when he was nominated. So when I think of conventions, I think of hallway conversations, I think of receptions and building relationships with people, and I'm looking forward to seeing some of the same people I met at that very first convention 30 years ago.
All right, well, let's see what Steve King has to say on those conventions. He says, quote, conventions are A, theater, B, politics, C, communicative, D, mindless fun, or E, all of the above. And Steve, the answer is?
Well, obviously it's all of the above. But I've only been attending conventions for about 10 years. Am I that much younger? Well, they're theater in that they're obviously there are different acts building up to some climax. They're communicative in that for the serious observer, if you're really looking and reading into the platforms and the resolutions and some of the political speeches, obviously, I think you are really getting some feel for the principle and the platform of the respective party. They're political, as Camille points out, in that they're really reunions. They're a political junkie's nirvana, if you will. It's Christmas, Easter, and birthday all rolled into one. And finally, they are fun. They're just like a reunion.
Okay, and finally to Linda Green, who thinks the most interesting thing about the upcoming Republican convention will be testing Thompson's coattails.
Yes, well, of course, this convention will provide some of the fun which my co-panelists have described. But my information tells me that one of the most important things about the convention is an opportunity to see some of the candidates who will be running in the next important elections. And in particular, the party has selected the U.S. Senate race and a showcase of the candidates, the Republican candidates in that race as a focus. And so one of the very important things about political parties can be and has been the function of the party to get candidates elected, to muster the support of the party, to inform the party about the candidates, and to try to determine which of the candidates can best carry forward the Republican banner. And my quote stresses, of course, the popularity of Governor Thompson, but also raises the question whether that popularity will carry through in the upcoming Senate race for the Republican candidates. They're running against a very, very somewhat popular incumbent who's already up in the air. He's got six offices open around the state, and he's treating this race very, very seriously. And so I think the question is whether the popularity of Governor Thompson will translate into any success for those candidates. I think it's still an open question.
Well, let's start with that race, since it is the showcase race for the Republicans. It seems like Bob Welch, Kate Zeisky, definitely the two front runners there. Who are going to be the big winners and losers coming out of this convention?
Well, I think one of the trends we've seen in political conventions is that the age of the people who go to conventions has risen, and also at both political conventions seem to attract people more. There will be more people who are conservative at the Republican convention than truly represents the entire Republican Party. You may disagree with that, Steve, but I think because of that, you have four candidates for the Senate race. One of the candidates is definitely pro-choice, and the others are, you know, anti-choice to one extent or another. And I think that the three candidates who aren't for choice are going to have a conservative audience to play to, and they will try to be more conservative than the other. And Matt Gunderson's role will be to try to play to the media if the media shows up and if the media even cares enough about it, and he could be the winner in terms of reaching out to the public. What do you think, Steve?
Well, this is Tommy Thompson's convention, let's face
yes.
it. And it's really in effect, the kickoff of his reelection effort. So it's to the extent that Linda says it's a coattail thing, yeah, we're going to hear from the Senate candidates in some kind of showcase event. But speaking from experience, I know that just winning the hearts and minds and souls of delegates and alternates to a convention doesn't necessarily translate into victory in the primary, but it's Tommy Thompson's convention, and this is really going to launch his reelection effort.
Right, and I would say that certainly the draft platform indicates the Republican Party's desire to frame an inclusive vision, one which also includes some of the important themes in Wisconsin politics, the progressive tradition, etc. Also, the platform, at least the draft, does not contain an anti-abortion plank, though rumor has it that some may try to propose a very conservative plank. Certainly, in trying to consolidate the Thompson Revolution, and that sort of language is used in the draft platform, it is important to build an inclusive but distinctive party, but which perhaps cannot stray so far from Wisconsin's progressive traditions if it hopes to add additional political victories to its shelf. And so I think that Tommy Thompson has certainly tried to walk that line, and certainly to the extent that the party continues in that direction, perhaps his popularity may transfer to some of the others.
Okay, well, we'll check it out in a week or so. Let's totally shift gears now and cruise what's known as the information superhighway, something near and dear to Camille's heart, since you are on the coalition to push it. It's been something debated in legislature all winter and spring. It looks like finally we might be moving to a special session on the information superhighway.
I hope so, and I'm glad you disclosed that I'm not an impartial observer here.
No.
I'm definitely in favor of Wisconsin being a leader in passing our version of the information superhighway legislation. What we really have here is an information revolution fueled by technology improvements and innovation and competition. And every state in the nation, as well as the federal government, is wrestling with modernizing their regulatory structures to manage a transition to a competitive telecommunications environment. And the goal in Wisconsin, we've done something a little different here in that at the beginning of last year, Governor Thompson appointed a blue ribbon telecommunications task force to look at the issue and to bring all of the various parties together to come to some kind of a consensus before bringing it to the legislature. It involved everyone in the industry, consumers and citizens, and they had hearings all over the state. And other states right now are looking to Wisconsin even before we've passed the legislation. And if we do pass this legislation, I think it will be a model for the rest of the country.
Right. And even without the legislation, the technology will move on, which brings a whole new bundle of problems, including privacy issues. Just the thought if you tap the wrong key, you might tap into someone's medical records or whatever. It's going to bring some challenge for lawmakers.
Perhaps not quite, but certainly one important feature of the legislation is that it's not simply a piece of legislation to manage the way that government, the private sector, and consumers will be affected by the information revolution. It also contains a number of features which focus on the privacy of a wide range of information and information sources which affect us, and that's very important. The issue of privacy becomes more important, but there are other features of the bill which are important. There are consumer protection features, which also, among other things, allow the Attorney General to bring suits if the rights of consumers are in some way violated under the provisions of the bill. There are also anti-competitive concerns and a concern that competition be, also just one other, universal access, which is extremely important. We don't want to leave anyone behind in the information revolution.
Okay. We'll have to let that be the last word. Thank you to all three for joining us today. Dave?
I want to know how Steve King escaped comment on the information highway. Well, we'll have to get him later on that. Thanks to Renee Riddle for filling in as this week's guest host from WISN-TV. Pleasure to have her here. And a reminder that we will be off the air next week thanks to the wonderful world of public television's auction. We'll see you again 2 weeks from tonight. I'm Dave Iverson. We'll see you then.
Health reporting on tonight's program is made possible in part by a grant from the University of Wisconsin Children's Hospital, caring for Wisconsin's children.